Are you ready? Momo? Okay. Welcome everybody. We have converged to receive a briefing on the draft Texarkana North Amendment Bill from the Treasury people and also staff. I must just indicate to members of the public who are here that on my left we've got the members of the Standing Committee on Finance. I'm the chairperson of the committee, Thabo Mofamadi. And they also represent different political parties. We will begin our presentation by giving Momiat, Ismail Momiat, Momo, the Deputy Director General from Treasury. And I must just indicate for record purposes that everything is being recorded so that tomorrow I didn't say we didn't say it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and may I also just congratulate you as the Chair and the members of the committee, and just say that we do look forward to a strong and deep relationship with the committee. We're very mindful, we don't want you to be co-opted by and have a good relation. We hope that you give us a hard time, exercise your oversight and legislative function, and tell us when we are wrong. I think that as public servants, we certainly, I think this process and this relationship is quite a critical one. Chair, I think just to start, can I say that, you know, my boss, the minister, apologized for not being able to come. He feels he does need to come and meet with the committee. He is caught up at WEF. So he asked me to convey his apologies. Chair, I think to start off with, this bill that we have before us gives effect to the tax proposals announced in the budget in February this year. I thought that needs to be made clear, because I know that we have many new members, and so nothing that you have here today should be a surprise in terms of a broad announcement. Yes, there are matters of detail, and in Texas, detail is important. All the proposals, therefore, you would find in Chapter 40, we have a budget review here for anyone who doesn't know, which we publish with the budget. You'll find them in Chapter 4 of the budget review and in Annexure C. There are copies, if anyone wants copies, they can get them from the Treasury, but they're also on the website. The bill that we're considering today is also coming through to you in terms of the existing parliamentary arrangement. As we're aware, there was a Money Bill Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, and that will kick in, but doesn't kick in for this bill. I understand it will kick in next year for the next budget. And certainly that's an issue we're going to have to talk about, is how do current ways of looking at this bill change, given that we have that act, but it doesn't apply for this particular piece of legislation and its passage before you in Parliament. I think that, also just to make the point, that this is the first presentation after, so we made the proposals in February. There's a lot of work that goes in between, because tax policies by or announcements are by their nature very market sensitive, and so we can't consult members of the public before they're announced in February. And for that reason, we can only really work on the legislation, not necessarily start, we could start on it before, but work on the detail once the proposals are announced, everybody out there has the information, and then we are able to consult with particular groups as we prepare legislation, and to make the point that we then publish the legislation. And I think very important that we do wait keenly for public comment, because we may not get it all right. The impact needs to be assessed by different players. And today's presentation is just to bring the proposals to, although they've been published last week, to actually hopefully get the media and everybody else to report on it, so that certainly by the deadline for comment on the 26th of June, we'll have received comments by everybody. We are aware that the tax practitioners here or the auditing companies will definitely be here to bet for their interests, and to the extent that it impacts on others, because it doesn't just impact on business, it's quite important that we get others who may be impacted on by this tax, by this bill. And the committee has kindly agreed to have hearings on the 24th of June, and thereafter, once we have the comments, we as a department go back, we revise the bill, and then table it probably sometime in August and bring it into the formal parliamentary process. So you will note, Chair, that this bill, this is the way we've dealt with it, that contrary to other reports, that this bill is a money bill that you have amended every year, and you need to amend it because there's a lot of detail in tax policy which needs to be looked at. So that's, I think, just by way of background. I won't go through all of this, but I think the full process is, I've just outlined that in more detail. It was published on the 1st of June. And of course, this part is a kind of informal process until we table it, after which it needs to go through, like all bills, to the state law advisors, and formally come to the Standing Committee on Finance. It used to be PCOF, it's now the Standing Committee. I think just by way of an overview, and to remind ourselves, because members, not all members were present or part of this committee, in fact most were not, in during the February budget, that just to make the obvious point, that the first objective that we have and will always have is to raise sufficient revenue. And it's become an even more important issue because, as you'll see just now, the economy is slowing down. Something that we've taken for granted, that every year we'll collect more than we budget, unfortunately is not an assumption we can make anymore. We also want to boost the economy and household confidence in spending, and hence we've introduced your relief on personal income taxes, so we all pay less tax for the same income than we did before the end of February. We take into account fiscal drag and try and offer real tax relief. It's just to make sure that as you have inflation, people move into upper brackets, they don't end up paying effectively more tax. And we deal with some rebate and threshold values. I'm sure most of us would have noticed that, because we would have noticed we got more money at the end of the month when we are paid, or in the middle of the month, whenever. Unless we lose our jobs, which is a real possibility in this instance. We also kind of support investment, so we've delayed the implementation of the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Royalty Act, which has been a long process in Parliament, but we've delayed it for 1 year. It should have taken effect this year. And we also introduce or give effect to the tax incentives that were announced in 2008. We also, I think quite importantly, Chair, have green fingers in this in these proposals, and I think this is quite important, that even though there may be a slowdown, we cannot risk the future of the world. And these measures are probably 100 years too late. And that's why we've made sure that we start implementing a green tax budget. And the main aim here is not often revenue. It's really to change behavior, human behavior, and to promote sustainable development, get energy efficiency. Of course, last year when the lights went out, we were keenly aware of it, but this year there's been a bit of surplus energy just because of the economic downturn. But I think it's quite important that we just keep that in mind. So these are the, even if your eyes aren't as good as mine, or as bad as mine, even if your eyes are as bad as mine, and we can't read that, we will come to these proposals in a moment, but I think perhaps the big headlines are important, that there's a whole lot of rates and threshold issues, so we don't change much else. Then the impact on individuals, the impact on business, impact on internationally or with regard to foreign investment, South Africans investing abroad or capital coming in. There's a whole lot of special entities like PBOs, public benefit organizations, and indirect taxes that we'll go through. So I will not repeat it here. Okay, I think what's also important to note is sometimes what's not here, and some of it is here, is that the electricity levy that we announced in 2008, we did not implement it last year for all sorts of technical problems that we encountered with municipalities. However, this year, we're quite determined to go ahead with it. It will proceed from the 1st of July. That's the intention. And I think that it's important that we don't delay that. We don't need new legislation for this chair. We can regulate it in terms of the current Customs and Excise Act, right? And we did, I know that SARS did publish for comment last year, but it's something that we can do via regulation. As I said, we delay the royalty, mineral royalties. We increase the general fuel levy, as we always do, and excises on tobacco and alcoholic products. We also introduced, as part of our green move, a tax on incandescent light bulbs, the light bulbs we all used to. We say you need to use the more energy efficient ones, even though they're more expensive. Just in terms of buying, but they will lead to lower electricity bills and help to save the world, to use what we call CFL. I think that's an important point to note here. And we also proposed amendments to the ad valorem excise duties on motor vehicles, and actually put it more in line in terms of our environmental objectives and a carbon component. There's a range of tax administration proposals which we deal with, which again we'll go through. But these are the areas, and I'm sure Franz Tomasek, my colleague, is here from SARS. And I forgot to introduce Cecil Morden, the head of tax policy unit, and Keith Engel, who heads in the Treasury the legal tax design chief directorate. They are the real experts on tax policy. I think, Chair, before we get into the detail, we also just wanted to give you a perspective on some of the numbers. Some of these numbers are old, some of these are new. But, you know, at the time of the budget in February, the tax proposals kind of resulted in us foregoing revenue of 13.5 billion rand. We change the thresholds on CIT, the brackets, and that means that we get less money because we get less money because if we had left things as they are, more people would have, for example, been paying tax at the 40% level at the highest bracket. But we increase the bracket so there's less, and therefore we forego about 13.5 billion, and that's in gross tax revenue, and in net tax revenue, because what we give with the one hand, we take with another, and in net terms, it was 4.6 billion. I think that just some interesting points to note is that the actual tax revenue for the last fiscal year, which ended on the 31st of March 2009. Remember, in February, the year has not ended, the old year. We're announcing for the new year that's supposed to start on the 1st of April. And that amount was 16.9 billion below what was announced in February last 2008. So we're sitting in February 2008, the minister makes a tax proposal for 1st of April to 31st of March 2008, and it's below that. And here, this is important to note, because if the money is below, remember the spending levels are already set. If nothing else happens, it means that your deficit or your borrowing is going to increase. And we revise this number down normally in October and also in the budget itself, because the budget this year, the year hadn't ended yet, and we were even lower. At that point, we knew much more that we were going to collect less revenue, but we still collected less than what we thought in February. It was 2.6 billion below. So I think you can see how the impact of the slowdown in the economy was coming through in revenues. And at the time we projected that for the February budget, for the new budget, for this fiscal year starting 1st of April this year and ending 31st of March next year, that we would collect 659 billion rand. And now we are it means that we have to project a higher growth than we did even from last year's revenue, because we collected less than we anticipated. In fact, early indications, we've been looking at the end of May numbers and we'll be publishing them shortly as we do every month, but we are expecting at least to be 8 billion rand below what we should have collected. And that's a big number to share. And, you know, given the much steeper slowdown in economic growth that we've seen, especially in the first quarter of this year, or this, of this calendar year, you know, the actual tax revenues were, and I don't think we need to be a rocket scientist or a great economist, to know that we are going to be significantly lower than that 659 billion. And I think that that's really an important point to note, and something that certainly as the year comes and when we revise our budget projections for this year, we're going to have to revise the revenue down. I think if you look at the next few slides, and you don't have to go through them, but this gives you all the tax proposals, the 4.5 billion net that we talked about at the time of the budget. This tells you what happened last year, how much we collected less than the three projections that we had, and this just tells you that the only year when we've collected less than what we budgeted for was in 2003, 2004, and last year. And this year, I will bet my salary that we'll have another yellow line. So. Yeah, I think I'll stop there. I'll ask my colleagues just to go through on the actual amendments themselves. That's it to you.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. This table just shows you the changes in the personal income tax bracket. On the left-hand side, you've got last year's 08 or 09 figures, and on the right-hand side, you've got the adjusted figures, largely for inflation. And we sort of played a bit of catch-up because the previous year we didn't fully adjust for inflation, and with a high inflation rate we had to adjust it slightly more. You also notice, Chair, that the primary rebate was also adjusted quite significantly compared to last year, providing extra relief at the bottom end of the market. In addition to adjusting brackets, we have also adjusted the thresholds with respect to this tax-free interest income from 19,000 to 21,000 for persons below 65 years, and then from 27,500 to 30,000 for people, and there's been a few other adjustments with respect to foreign dividends and the CGT. Thank you. Seems I'm going to have to stretch. I'll move. It's just the one slide. I'll be talking to you very briefly. In the provisional tax space, there's a threshold that exists to reduce the amount of work that our pensioners have to do to create, send forms into SARS, and that's an 80,000 rand threshold. If you have less income than that, you do not need to make those estimates, which are twice a year followed by a third top-up. And essentially, that threshold needs to strike a balance between reducing the paperwork and then being confronted with quite a large bill when you're assessed. So we've looked at that, and because we've had increases in the tax threshold, below which you do not pay tax as a pensioner, we've thought it would be appropriate to propose increasing the threshold to assist the over 65s. Then the next slide, Chair, is the deduction, the adjustment in the threshold with respect to medical scheme contribution. This is again a monetary threshold that we adjust more or less for inflation on an annual basis. And those are the figures. I'm not going to go through all of them. They are there. An important change that we envisage is that we converting the deduction into a credit as from 2011-2012. And we propose that that tax credit would be around the 50% mark, which means that people that are at the marginal rate of below 50% will actually get an additional benefit, and people that are above that will be slightly at a disadvantage. This will provide some better equity in terms of the deduction. There's also another change in terms of just the admin associated with this particular proposal, is that the medical fringe benefit concept will be revised. All contributions will now be made by the employee as a deduction, and the contribution by the employer to the employee on for medical will be regarded as ordinary income, so that you have one system to simplify it. Then a proposal that has been in the coming over the past few years was the whole issue of car allowance or motor vehicle allowance. The first two slides in this respect just give you some figures, just shows you the number of taxpayers that actually claim motor vehicle allowances and the average allowance that per taxpayer. And that gives you sort of a distribution by income group or by taxable income, not gross income, but by taxable income. This slide just shows you the actual number of taxpayers that claimed the various deductions in the tax system, largely with respect to pension and annuities and medical expenses and car allowance. Those are the three or four main deductions that individuals can claim. It just shows you the average per individual also. And you'll notice, Chair, that the amount claimed by people for travel expenses, which is the second last or third last row, which is in blue here, fixed cost, which is the deemed kilometer system, it's about 517,000 taxpayers in 2004-05 and 450 in 2005-06. And you'll see at the top there is a percentage in brackets that shows you percentage assessed. So this is not a full picture, because at the time we draw this, this wasn't all the taxpayers, but we can update that as more data becomes available. But it gives you an idea about the quantum of the amount involved here. And you'll see that the amount per individual that is claimed for deemed kilometer is significantly higher than any of the others, and which indicates that there is a problem here. We propose to do away completely with the deemed kilometer system, and individuals that then still use their private cars for business purposes can claim actual expenses. And we think that would be a more equitable system for people that genuinely use their cars for business purposes. And in the same breath, we are proposing to increase the pay-as-you-earn portion of that allowance to 80% to ensure that people are not out of pocket at the end and don't claim allowance up front and then blame the tax system for hitting them at the end. Okay.
Okay, this is what we're talking about here is when you retire, you sort of you get two streams of income when you retire. You get a lump sum benefit, and you also get an annuity, depending on the type of retirement vehicle you have. So most of the people in this room have a typical pension or an RA, which would give them a one-third lump sum, two-thirds annuity. In the lower income brackets for unions, you'll typically see a Provident Fund, which is solely a lump sum benefit. Anyway, we all have retirement vehicles, and they pay out. Now, they generally are supposed to pay out on retirement, but they also pay out before should you lose your job, or should you leave your job. And we used to have a very complicated system, this very difficult formula, to figure out how you tax these lump sums. And you had A's over B's, and God only knows what was going on. And last year we announced major changes to simplify the whole thing so you could see what was going on. And there are basically two tables here. There's this table and the next pick table. But you can kind of go back and forth. You just go back and forth there for a minute. You'll see that the pre-retirement table is not as generous as the post-retirement table. Because we really want you to take the money out after you retire, not before. But we recognize that if you do lose your job, you may need the money. And there are a number of issues around that. At this stage, we're mostly simplifying the system. Now, the key thing to note about these two tables is they work in tandem. So the more you take out, the more you go up the scale. And it's sort of a discouragement to not take out so quickly. So, for example, let's just start with what you've got there. Let us say you take out $100,000 under pre-retirement. And then you take out, first job lost, you take out $100,000. You'll find yourself topping out at the 18% bracket. Let's say many years later, you have been employed for a while, and then you take out another $800,000. You'll find that what happens is that the tables accumulate. So what will happen is when you take out the first $100,000, $100,000, you take out the next $800,000, I don't know if I showed the right number here, it's almost as if you've taken out $900,000 in that second shot. You will only be taxed on $800,000, but you'll be taxed on higher brackets. Mm-hmm. And so as you go up the brackets each time you withdraw. Because we don't want people serially withdrawing. Now that also, the pre-retirement, now we go to the post-retirement table, also has the same thing. Now your pre-retirement count against your post-retirement formula. So I sort of give you an example on the next page, but on the next page you'll see a simple example, and hopefully I've got the numbers right, where you receive $400,000 pre-retirement, which would mean that your bracket on the first $400,000 stops at 18%. Then if you take out another $300,000, it's as if you're taking out between $400,000 and $700,000. So that $300,000 on retirement, you'll find yourself between the 18% and the 27% bracket. So the bottom line is that this formula now, by the way, is more favorable than the personal income tax formula. You'll typically see. The rates are better here because we're trying to help retirement. But the bottom line is the more you withdraw, the more you catch up. But we're really trying to discourage pre-retirement withdrawals in a slight way. There are some bigger issues around there. Again, a lot of these changes were announced last year, but because of the way bills are done, you only got to see the tables this year. There's a complicated reason for that. You really don't want to hear why, but that's what it is. So that's those two things. Now, a small issue is on the next one is minor beneficiary funds. And all these small issues come up. Now, by the way, if you think retirement is simple, you're greatly wrong. It seems like it should be simple, but I don't know how many things I've been dragged into in this area. One of the main problems in retirement is all the effective date issues. But in this issue, this is a small but very urgent issue, and that is minor beneficiary funds come out of the Fidentia scandal. And what happened was, and these changes were announced last year on the regulatory side, that the minor beneficiary funds were just typically unregulated trusts. But they were regulated under the Trust Controls Act, but that really didn't mean anything. And so what they did is the concerns were that when somebody died and left their funds in a, and they left their savings in a fund for their children, who were typically under 18, the question is, how do you take care of those children? And they wanted to make sure that they would be in a regulated environment. And so now the FSB is governing the supervision of these funds. Now, in 2008, we tried to make a tax system we thought would be simple, but it turned out to be a little more complicated than we had hoped. But what happens is, in 2008, we said, if somebody dies and leaves their amount to a minor beneficiary fund, it really doesn't, it's actually not left to a minor beneficiary fund. What happens is, when somebody dies and they have money in their retirement fund, sometimes the retirement fund takes a look and they appoint their own people. Because what they say is, look, there are no guardians here. You know, the oldest child is 19. Or we don't feel the guardian is suitable. They say we'd rather have these funds go to a special trust fund, i.e. these new FSB funds, to protect the children. Now when that happens, what we said in the tax world is, the movement to that fund is tax-free, the growth in the fund is tax-free, but when you pay out, it's taxable. And the reason we chose that was, that's the way an annuity works. So if you pass away, and your spouse inherits an annuity, under current law, there's no charge on death, the growth is tax-free, but the payout is taxable. Something called EET. That's what we were trying to model. However, we quickly got a number of calls from various funds, and they said it wasn't doable. And the reason why is, if you have to worry about a payee slip every time you pay the orphan, it starts creating a very expensive cost administratively. And a lot of these amounts going to the orphans is very, very small. So we ended up reverting the system as if you paid a lump sum on death, and therefore it's taxable on death, tax-free on growth, tax-free payout. And having spoken to the FSB, the various minor beneficiary fund regulators, they preferred that system. I think we do have some concerns here whether some tax should be paid at all because these amounts are so low. But this process is an improved one, and it is an incentivized system at this stage. And I think the industry is on board with that. Then there's another issue on the employer side. Sometimes pensions build up so much that they have actual surpluses that really belong to the employer. Now that happens rarely and a lot less as a result of a number of regulations, but it does come up. Now typically when the money goes back to the employer, it's taxable, and it's taxable under the assumption that the employer got a deduction for putting the money in. However, it turns out there are a small number of cases that employers may make payment with respect to a pension surplus where it was non-deductible. This would happen when you take over a business. So we said, look, if you didn't get a deduction going in, you should not have income going out. And that changed. Then we move on to post-retirement and medical aid. Another area that comes along that's related is employers who provide post-retirement medical aid. Now, that's more of an older phenomenon than a new phenomenon, but one benefit that you can really offer your employees is after they retire, you'll cover the medical aid. And it's a very strong incentive. And the reason why it's such a strong incentive is that when you look at medical aid, it goes up. You know, you look at medical costs, that exceeds average inflation. And there are many medical costs when you're older that you become more and more concerned about it. So if you have an employer who provides that, that is a great employer. And what happens, though, for the employer, though, is they are maintaining a very costly item on their books. And that shows up on their books regularly. And that is a very difficult thing to deal with when the financial advisors take a look and say whether this company is a valuable company. So they try to get rid of the liability, and they do this by making a lump sum payment to the employee. And say, employee, instead of getting this over life, we'll give you a big cash amount. But most employees aren't interested. Most employees would rather have that annuity. So sometimes another option is to pay a life insurance company, and then the life insurance company will take care of the employee. And they will basically assume the employer's obligation. Now, what we've done is we've allowed that to be immediately deductible for the employer, because the employer is not getting any benefit. It's really an expense. Frankly, it's not as favorable as accounting. Accounting would provide the losses earlier, but that we felt was a fair solution. The reason why you didn't get it under own law was because it was something called a capital expenditure, as we discussed yesterday. That was if you were paying for a tree, and that was not deductible. So that we gave it a deduction. There is an issue you might hear about is whether you should be able to get a deduction if the insurer doesn't take over all of the obligation. At this stage, we said the employer must take over all of the obligation. There were some concerns that if the insurance company doesn't take over all of the obligation, it's really an investment product. Anyway, that's more than that. You want to cover that one, Sergeant?
Chair, this is an amendment we're making to existing legislation with respect to learnership. What we did about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, was to encourage employers to make use of opportunities to upskill their workers, and there was an additional reduction provided, and it was linked to the actual wages or salaries of learnership. We have simplified the system quite a bit and proposed a particular cap of $30,000 per annum for an employer that signs up a learner, so that's an initial allowance, and then $30,000 on the completion. On the assumption that a learnership is 1 year, that employer will then get a deduction of $60,000 for the year, and you can work it out what's the actual benefit by multiplying with the tax rate of the company, which is normally 28% for small business, slightly different. An important change we've made also was for longer-term learnership, there was only an initial allowance and an end allowance, and there was an argument that there was discrimination, and so we will now provide an annual total top-up at the end of the completion of the learnership, which is basically equal to $60,000 per annum. Of it. In addition to that, we've also have an extra benefit for people that are disabled, which will be a top-up of $20,000, will bring that to $50,000. That's one.
Okay. Now, what this is about is the estate duty. Now, in the estate duty, when you pass away, you have an automatic $3.5 million deduction, which basically is a $3.5 million exemption, but we call it a deduction in the estate duty. So basically, if you have an estate of less than...
Yours is your estate.
It's your estate. Okay, my estate. Technical correction. So the point is, your estate has a $3.5 million amount you can ignore. Now, that's very nice, but what happens when you're married, you've got to think of it this way. When you're married, you have... There's one person who dies with $3.5 million. The spouse also has another $3.5 million. So effectively, the parents can give $7 million tax-free. But if you're going to give it away, well, not give it away, you're going to pass away and let it go to your children. What you, in order to get the benefit of both $3.5 million, you have to enter into a series of planning strategies. Because if you don't die a certain way, you don't move assets a certain way, you'll find that you only get to use one of the $3.5 million. Fair enough. So what you'll hire estate advisors and so forth to assist in your planning of your estate. And one of the most common ways to get yourself to the $7 million is to say when one spouse dies, $3.5 million goes into a marital trust. And then you have this marital trust, which is typically a house. And there's some complications of maintaining this marital trust, and you then have all these other costs that go on. And what we've been trying to do is basically have a rollover of the $3.5 million without the marital trust, to keep it quite simple. So if one spouse dies and they don't leave any to the children, because generally you want to leave most of your things to your spouse, although we had an internal debate about that. Some of us trust our spouses more than others, but maybe I'm a fool. But the point is that the money rolls over and you want it to just happen automatically without calling the lawyers and all the estate people involved. We also have a special rule that should you be so fortunate as having multiple spouses, you can take the $3.5 million and diversify it. Just one thing about this to note, and I'm sure there are going to be some comments on this, it's fairly restrictive. You've got to leave all of the money to the spouse. And the reason why we did that was administrative concerns of keeping record keeping. That's why we were acting the way we were. However, I think we wouldn't mind getting a more flexible result if we can get there administratively. Because sometimes people do want to leave their children a little earlier. So that is that issue. Anyway.
That's why
you've
got to get married.
Thanks, Keith. coming to some of the green issues that Momo mentioned earlier, Chair, is here we are proposing an exemption for income generated as a result of the sale of what is called certified emission reductions. In terms of environmental initiatives, we have what is known as the Kyoto Protocol, where industrialized countries have committed to the reduction of carbon emissions or greenhouse gas emissions broadly over a period of time. Part of that is deals with the issue of emissions trading, and a component thereof deals with what is called CDM projects, or clean development mechanisms, where developed countries can invest in developing countries and thereby earning credits towards their emission reduction. Many of the more advanced or more advanced developing countries like China and India and Brazil have made quite a lot of use of this. In South Africa, it has been slow in taking, and there's a couple of administrative problems associated with it, but one of the obstacles was the tax issue. And over a couple of months, we have engaged the experts in this area, and in the end, we have proposed, Chair, that the earnings related to the CERs, or Certified Emission Reduction, be exempt from income tax purposes to help boost this type of project. And we hope this will kickstart and give a boost to the project in South Africa. And there's quite a few of them on the go, mostly with related to renewable energy. And then another initiative as part of this whole environmental fiscal reform linking to what was mentioned earlier on our initiative to start taxing carbon through the environmental tax, a lot of arguments came to the table. We should also look at incentives rather than just taxing. Let's look at incentives, and this is one of the incentives that we think will make a difference, is to encourage energy efficiency. It has two objectives, basically. One is to help with the whole electricity demand that we're facing in this country, and people will become more energy efficient, and it also has an environmental spin-off. We have grappled with the exact design of this proposal. Initially, we wanted to link it to investment, as in the budget review, but we ran into problems in terms of labeling equipment. We don't have an effective system in this country where energy-efficient equipment are labeled, and therefore we've proposed a slightly different method where you actually measure the actual energy efficiency savings and then get the benefit associated with the savings. We have to rely a lot on the experts, so the DME, the Energy Efficiency Agency, will have to certify this, and based on their input, a notional deduction will be allowed. The brief method that you can claim this deduction is the actual savings, energy efficiency savings that is being certified by the Energy Efficiency Agency. We take multiply with the rate, which we now propose that we will use the minimum feed-in tariff that NERSA has announced for new renewable energy projects, and we'll take 50% of that, which we think is quite generous at this stage. And we will probably have to refine this proposal after the consultation process, but that's the substance of it. Lastly, on the environmental issues, Chair, we have existing ad valorem excise duties on motor vehicles, which is largely sort of a luxury tax. We have proposed changes to that, reducing the first component, which I don't have the slide on here, but it's in the budget review, and then proposing a second component, which is a carbon component. And on the left of this table, you'll see the carbon emissions. We can also replace that with actual engine size, which is very closely linked to carbon emissions. But for now, given that there is a labeling system in the country which we can use, and then there's a progressive CO2 emission tax, which we're proposing. There has been suggestion that we should up the upper limits from 12% to maybe to a higher level, because there are quite a number of vehicles apparently that emit something in the order of 400 and more, and we will have a look at that.
Okay, now we get to some of the heavier stuff, so hopefully if you've enjoyed that part of the presentation, the next part may be less so.
Those from the other firms stand up.
So this is where a lot of the action is. Now, this is just a little bit of a leftover from last year. Last year we announced, well actually it was about the year before, I'm not sure what year we announced, but we announced that we were going to convert the dividend tax from a company level tax to a shareholder level tax. So the tax rate of 10% will be the same on dividends, but will shift from going to the company to the shareholder. Well, that doesn't sound very significant. It is pretty significant. The first issue is that the old tax is falling on the company, so it's affecting the company books, with creating liability on the company books and lowering the accounting profits. And that was the main issue that was at stake. The second issue is that once you convert it to a shareholder tax, you start being entitled to exemptions, which the old system didn't have, if the dividends go to particular people. Now, we put in the main tax in 2008, but there's still, we just put the basic rubrics in place and made sure we bedded that down. And what we basically did is shifted it over to a 10% tax. We created a number of exemptions. For instance, dividends to pension funds are exempt. Treaty access is available and a whole host of other things. We also put in a withholding system because the old system had an automatic withholding system in it, which was fairly simple. The new system, unfortunately, has to be a little bit more complicated. Anyway, we put in the basics of that regime last year, and then we put some other additions now this year into the next slide. There was a number of things that we've done that is more collateral I'm not going to get into that we refined last year's system. What we were trying to do is have the system in place to give people enough comment time to make sure we firm down the basics. Now we're going on to the collateral issues. The first issue, which is a fairly big issue, is pre-sale dividend stripping. Now, for those who are company tax experts, this is a fun area. For others, less so. When you're talking about this area, what you're talking about is converting, your character conversion gains, where if you get a dividend, you can get tax-free treatment, because in the new world, all company-to-company dividends are exempt. But if you sell the shares, you'll be taxable. So selling a taxable dividend is tax-free. What are you going to try to do? You're going to try to push things from taxable sales to dividends. Now, you can do that legitimately, or you can sort of massage the facts to get where you want to go. What we're concerned is where people are massaging the facts. Where companies have extra excess profits and cash on hand, and they want to distribute a dividend, will be unaffected. But when you sell a company, there are many ways to do it. One way is with a leveraged buyout. So what the company does that you're selling is you basically have a borrowing against the company. And that borrowing is used to create a dividend. But basically that borrowing is being comes into existence because the buyer has created the borrowing, even though it gets more complicated than that. Anyway, these are some of the character conversion games. I'll let you know that there's a number of these games going on under current law. I think we're being very generous postponing this amendment into the new dividend tax. But that's what we announced, and we stick to our announcement. So, but that is going on currently. Now, another area is shared distribution. Now, under current law and last year's version of the bill, we said, instead of distributing cash, you may want to distribute more shares. So, for example, a company may have 1 million shares on its books and say, look, instead of distributing cash this year, we're going to distribute another 1 million to the current shareholders. That's called a capitalization issue. So you start out with 1 share and then you end up with 2 shares. That should be tax-free, but there's different forms of share distribution. Some share distributions where everybody starts with 1 share and ends with 2 shares is fine, because there's no change in value at the shareholder level. But there are other share distributions where you have a value shift at the shareholder level. For example, if I give 500 shares to one set of people and then I give cash to another, the people who got cash are being taxed, but the other guys who get the 500 shares are having a greater interest in the company as a whole. And whenever that proportional interest changes, we become concerned there's a value shift. And what we're doing in the new regime is we're imposing a dividend tax whenever that value shift occurs. Then there's some more fun things, which is called deemed dividends. You have actual dividends, and then you have deemed dividends, or sometimes people refer to them as constructive dividends. Now, what happens here is people say, look, if I'm going to have a dividend, I'm going to be taxed. So how can I get the money out without calling it a dividend? So again, it's another labeling issue. Now, one typical way of doing that is a loan advance or debt, and that's the one I'm going to focus on here. Typically, if you're a small business owner, you don't want to pay the dividends if you distribute the dividends out. So instead, what you do is you take a loan from the company, but you never pay it back, or you keep deferring. The current STC has special rules to stop that. And they have deemed dividend rules to say, well, look, if you're going to play games with us, we will come back at you and treat them as actual dividends. And what we've basically done is we've replicated those rules into the new dividend regime. So just as the old STC has deemed dividends, the new one has it. The new rules are actually a little more generous because some of the current law is actually creating taxation when it shouldn't exist. And so we've actually modified it a little bit here. So that's essentially what's going on. Then we have some special items, and one of them, two of them that come up deals with telecommunications. And what happens is the telecommunication industry early this year has undergone the fourth conversion, which was actually the benefit of the industry as a whole. Under prior law, you had selective licenses. And those selective licenses, you can only have mobile phones or internet or landlines. What they did in order to level the playing field is they allowed a conversion where you get a comprehensive license, to state it in plain and simple terms. And that conversion is designed to put everybody on the same field. So you'll see lots of new things like Neotel and Vodacom's offerings have changed. And the only problem with the conversion is if you have a conversion, you technically have a capital gains event. Because every disposal, and a disposal includes a whole host of things, creates a capital gains event, and all of a sudden a regulatory conversion designed to assist the industry is taxing the industry. So we basically said it, that conversion is a non-taxable event. It is a what we call a rollover event, which means it's a nothing. And whatever your tax attributes before, stay afterward. And it's as simple as that. Then there's other things you begin to learn about in tax called international submarine telecommunications cable. Whatever that means is, it's a big underlying cable off the coast of Africa. And I believe it's off the east coast of Africa, but I got a little nervous in the slide and didn't want to say too much. So what this cable is designed to do is to make sure we have faster internet access. Because if you talk to people in London, they say our internet access is slightly slow. And if you're an IT person, that freaks you out. So the new system is going to be much better, much more efficient, and the only thing is how do you create one of these? You've got to finance it. Well, when you finance it, you can have a joint ownership in a cable, or you can have something called an indefeasible rights of use, which is really just a long-term lease. But the problem is our tax law doesn't recognize either one. And so what we're basically doing is giving a depreciation incentive. Well, not really an incentive, but a rule that just matches the accounting. The accounting gives you a 5% write-off, the tax will give you a 5% write-off. So it's not really an incentive. Then there's another one that's kind of related to that, and it's sort of a complicated issue, but let me just boil it down simply, and that is improvements on leased government land. If you make an improvement on somebody else's land, you cannot get a deduction if that other party is tax-exempt. The reason why is that you have a mismatch. There'll be a deduction for the payor, the tenant, but the party on the other side won't have comparable income. Now that has in the past, especially in the early 80s, I understand, have led to a fair amount of avoidance schemes. And we were concerned about changing that rule, but the problem is that if you didn't change the rule, what happens is if you build an improvement on government land, especially municipal land, you'll find that you can't get a deduction. And that discourages you from building on municipal land. And the municipalities are often trying to encourage you to build infrastructure by building on the land. So we've come up with a compromise solution at the moment to say that government-owned land where the leasing is 20 years or more will let you have a deduction. And it amounts to a 5% deduction, which is basically the same as ownership for commercial buildings at 5%. So it's just an evening out. And this is another fun title here, liquidation of residence companies. This is some of these sexy tax titles that you'll see. But what this is about is people have made the mistake of putting their homes in companies. And I don't know if any of you have any of these things, But most of us like to own our home outright. Why would you enter into such a thing? Why would you put your home in a company? Well, the reason why you did it many years ago was to avoid a number of taxes. Most specifically, you were trying to avoid the transfer duty. Because under old law, if you sold a house, you had transfer duty. But if you sold a company that owned the house, you didn't have transfer duty. And so there became a little market of these things where people had their homes in companies. And what we did many years ago is we closed down this scheme in a fairly harsh way, some would say. And we said, to the extent that you sell a company that's just got basically a home in it, the transfer duty will apply. So there was no reason to keep this. In addition, there's been a whole bunch of other taxes coming into the fray. So if you put your home in a company now, you've actually done something that is not very smart, because you're subject to at least three or four levels of tax. Now, we gave people a two-year window many years ago to get out of this regime. Some people didn't take advantage of it. We are now renewing that period to let them liquidate these companies tax-free. The reason why is now the DTI is now imposing charges on companies to maintain them. So now there's yet another burden, and so therefore we're allowing a tax-free liquidation, and basically it's rollover treatment. So it comes out tax-free, it's not preferred, it rolls over all the benefits. Okay, another one, shelf companies. Now, the world of the DTI is trying to eliminate shelf companies, actually. Because when it comes to shelf companies, they'd rather have you go to the DTI and ask for a new company. But the current company law and the old company law, it's difficult to get your company registered quickly. So what people did is they set up these things, where you'd have special people who would set up shelf companies. You would, instead of going to the DTI, these people would go and get from DTI about 500 companies for you. And they would have them sitting on the shelf. So whenever you came, you could buy one of these companies. The difficulty was is the tax system doesn't work very well. Because we have certain rules that stop you from having multiple shareholdings, especially when it comes around small business. So when you're a small business owner, we let you own one company. We don't let you own 30 or 40 companies, because then you're not a small business owner anymore. And what people do without such rules is they take a big company and break it up. So when you're a small company, you're not allowed to hold multiple companies. The problem is, when you're a shelf company owner, you have hundreds of companies, but they're all dormant. And when they sell those companies, you find that once that shelf company goes over to the new owner, who's a genuine small business, that the ownership by the shelf company owner prevents some rules. Most particularly, it prevents the presumptive tax from applying. If you want to choose a presumptive tax small business let out, you can't get it if you buy from a shelf company. The other one is just basic small company relief. So we said, if you're these kind of companies, we basically let go, and that's what we've done. You want to cover this one here?
Sure. Thanks, Keith. Last year, we introduced a mechanism to encourage equity investment in small and medium-sized companies. We had a long debate on this issue about the lack of equity investment into small and medium-sized companies, and we created what we call a venture capital company. In order to make sure that this thing worked, we had lots of rules in place to make sure that the way it actually works is that a venture capital company is set up, individuals or companies can invest in that venture capital company, and that venture capital company are then required to invest into prescribed or certain type of small businesses. There were certain rules that the staff has to give upfront approval, and then the venture capital company has to meet that requirement after 36 months. That proved to be a bit cumbersome, and so we changed that, Mr. Chair. There was a restriction on the type of income that these companies can earn. Non-qualifying income requirement of 10% was imposed. We've now upped that to 20%. There was also certain limits on the size of the investment that needs to be made. We've done away with a very small investment of less than 5 million, and what is in place is the 10 million mark is still in place. And very importantly, the last point is that in order for this to work and not to have collusion with companies actually doing their normal investment and claim this benefit, we had the restriction of the benefit that there must be at least a company can't claim more deduction if it has an excess of 10% share in a venture capital company. After a representation, we've now decided to increase that to 40%. This is an initiative that is supposed to start off from the 1st of July next year, and obviously these changes will impact on the nature of that approval charge.
Okay, now we get to the heavier stuff. Now, you'll see these coming up every time. Just for the committee's knowledge, there are areas that you will always see us talking about. There'll be some sort of company-level tax, dividend tax, reorg, something like that going on. And the other area that comes along is CFC. Now, a CFC stands for Controlled Foreign Company. Now, what a controlled foreign company is simply is a foreign subsidiary of a South African company. Now, many of our South African companies have offshore subsidiaries. And there are lots of rules around that to make sure that we get some level of tax out of them, the minimal level, but we get some level of tax out of them, and also to prevent avoidance. Now, our system is more avoidance-based. There's been a number of issues there, but one of the things that we try to look for is we don't want people sending their passive income offshore solely to avoid South African tax. We also don't want them playing games of transfer pricing. However, if they have legitimate businesses abroad, we don't tax them in order to make sure they remain competitive with foreign operations. So if you're if you've got a subsidiary in France or Australia or the UK, or you've got it somewhere in Botswana, there's a Botswana company subject to a 25% rate, and we have an active operation in Botswana, we'll also leave it to the 25% Botswana rate. We don't want it to be subject to that 28% South African rate. It makes it less competitive. So there's a lot of complicated rules as to what the balance is. Active stuff okay, passive diversionary stuff bad. So that's sort of the line that has fallen out over the years. The two areas that come about is, one, what is active? And that's something called a foreign business establishment. And we have had a number of rules around those, and what we're doing is we're cleaning them up a little bit. The rules in this area are very objective. They're very detailed and they're very technical. And one thing that does not count is intent. We just take a look. Did you do it or not? And that is to protect the revenue service, because once you get into battles over intent, a big company can invent intent like no tomorrow. And if they can't invent it, then any advisor who can't do so should be fired immediately. And so instead of getting into intent, we basically have objective rules. And what we had last year was a series of ruling waivers that gave SARs the power to overcome those objectives if they felt there was reasonable circumstance. But it left it in a difficult situation for SARs because they were making policy rulings. And rulings should not be policy. They really should be interpretation. But based on the facts that we had, we felt we could put them into direct law. And that's what we've done here. We've tightened the definition of foreign business establishment, but we've also done a number of relaxations. For example, we allow group company activities to be taken into account. The other thing that we did, which is going to be, I think the industry is going to like that, whether they like it enough, I don't know, but they should like this somewhat, is if you're in a high-tax country, we decide that we're not going to bother you at all, no matter what you do. The bottom line is, if you're going to a high-tax country, well, you're going to be taxed there instead of here. There's no tax incentive to leave. This doesn't make any sense. So we have basic rules to say, if the company is subject to a 20% statutory rate or more, and it's subject to global tax of 75% or more of our rate, the rate is so large, it's not worth the tax planning. And it saves SARs also time, so they don't have to audit things they're not going to get much of a yield off. Then another issue, back to the new dividend tax. In the current world, you get a dividend. It comes to you as a tax-free dividend. It looks tax-free to you anyway. The company is taxed at 10%, but if you are a shareholder and you get such a thing, it looks tax-free. Under the new world, you will know that the 10% tax is yours. The question was how to deal with foreign shares. Now, the shares on the JSE under current law are completely exempt based on the premise that the South African dividends were exempt. But now that the South African dividends are going to be subject to a 10% rate, the foreign dividends have to be subject to the same rate, otherwise people will have an incentive to buy foreign shares over domestic shares. And I will turn it over to Franz for PDP.
Thank you, Jim. Well, this is another area where you'll see the odd tweet coming through from time to time as we move to assist certain public benefit activities and organizations. And in this particular piece of legislation, it's no different. We have two areas where we're tweaking. The one relates to certain transformational activities that are being conducted by agricultural trusts that were in fact formed by the Department of Agriculture. Now, if you read the existing public benefit activities carefully, many of the activities these trusts are carrying out are covered, but there are a couple that are not. And so essentially what we're doing here is we're tweaking it so that we can cover those activities. And then there's a second leg, and that really is very timely, and that is about consumer education about finances. If you think about where we sit today with the current economic crisis, one of the building blocks of the COVID crisis was the fact that people in the US did not know what they were getting themselves into when they undertook certain kinds of loans. And so in this context, it makes a great deal of sense to, in fact, make sure consumers are educated about the way finances work in the loan sphere, in the financial sphere. And so there is a consumer education foundation that the FSB has established that does that kind of work. And again, we're putting something in there to assist them so that the donations to that particular foundation will, in fact, be tax-deductible donations for the industry. So essentially, industry will be helping contribute towards their consumers understanding what it is that they're getting themselves into. Turning to the next slide, we have a set of rules that deal with the exemptions for PDOs and clubs, sporting clubs, recreational clubs. And essentially, the rule means that you need to come to SARS to get approval before you're exempt. But some of these clubs are perhaps not as sophisticated as they should be. They don't come to us in time. And so what we have here is a proposal that where they have stuck to the broad outlines of what you would need to qualify for exemption, and you come to us late, we can retrospectively approve you so that you in fact get your exemption going backwards. Okay, so that assists people who, as I say, just come in a little bit late but have in fact been doing things properly. They haven't been trying to move outside the parameters of what a proper club or a proper CBR. And then finally, in this particular segment, we have provisional tax. Now, the idea behind provisional tax is that you settle your tax liability over the course of the year so that there isn't a large liability at the end. And when we permitted public benefit organizations to in fact trade as a subset of what they do, we thought it logical that they too should be subject to provisional tax. Now, as it turns out, but we realized that might be a bit difficult, so there was a window period of 2 years where they would not be. After accepting representations from the sector, we've proposed in here that 2 year period in fact be extended indefinitely so that they do not need to make provisional tax payments. The upside here is that, again, there's less of a compliance burden on them. The downside is that they may in fact find themselves, again, at the end of the year with an assessment with a substantial liability that they now need to find the funds for. So this is something that we're going to have to monitor as we go along. If we find people are getting themselves into trouble, we may have to consider coming back to this. But at the moment, that's what people would like, and we're prepared to assist them, and we're making that proposal.
Okay, then, just getting toward the close of my portion here. There are film incentives. Now, these have been around for quite some time. Now, we have sort of two competing objectives here, but the main objective is we're trying to assist the film industry in order to promote local production. And we have a fairly strong South African film base. I must say that I'm impressed with many of the TV programs here, and having seen many recent South African films, I think we have quite an impressive crew. The difficulty is, of course, that the world is a tough one, and unless you have a big Hollywood budget blockbuster, it makes it difficult to break in. but the South Africans have consistently tried to build a film production industry. One of the things that DTI does is they provide a grant. And the DTI grant has, it's usually between 10 million a film. Sometimes it goes to 20, but most of the time it's 10 million rand a film. And there, we actually try to assist that incentive by making sure the grant is tax-free. Fair enough. The difficulty is when we did it, we didn't take into account the commercial reality of how their film scheme worked. And in their film scheme, they require all the money to go into a special purpose vehicle. And then the money goes to the film owner. Well, we let it go into a special purpose vehicle, but we don't let it shift to the film owner. So we've extended the incentive to allow that. The other area that the tax system has directly put an incentive is something called 24F, or an immediate write-off for film costs. Now, when you deal with costs, that is, again, a capital expenditure. And typically, you will not get a deduction for it. We have given an incentive to that in order to encourage people to enter into the film industry, and we're looking for legitimate films. Now, in the way it works is 24F had a lot of rules around it. There was some avoidance that went on in years past. I think we generally closed it down. And what's happened now is that in some cases the film rules are a little too restrictive, and in some cases they need to be refined a little bit further. So what we've done is on the incentive is we've adjusted a little bit. We've adjusted it to assist with legitimate film production. Instead of having a 10-year period, what happens is you can pay for the money up front, the film directly, but you also may want to rely on borrowing. The borrowing, you had to repay in 10 years. Now we're letting you repay in 15 years because of the decline in interest rates. But we've had some other tails in it as well, and that's essentially what we've done there. Then the indirect tax and share block companies. There is, and this is now we're talking about is transfer duty. Whenever you buy a piece of property, you should be subject to the VAT or the transfer duty. Now, if a developer develops the land and they sell you property, there is no transfer duty. And they often try to tell you, there's no transfer duty. It's such a great tax deal, buy in. What they don't tell you is that there's a VAT. But that's the selling technique they use. But there's always one tax or another. Now, one area, though, that has come into a bit of a problem, and that is fractional share ownership. You'll see that also. That's one of the latest things that people do. And they're not doing it for tax. They're actually doing it for other reasons. So if you have a fractional share company where you sell shares that represent fractional shares, it appears they're not subject to transfer duty. They are subject to the VAT on the initial sale, but the subsequent transfer duty doesn't apply. And what we've done is we've tried to make sure that the transfer duty applies to those fractional share interests just as if you bought a regular interest. And that's just to even the playing field. Just one point as I close here, and I turn it over to Franz. Just in terms of your materials, I know this stuff is fairly heavy. If you look at the bottom of all your titles, we have the reference clauses here to the bill. Because if you look at your bill, to make it even harder to read, there's the actual clauses in the bill and the actual amendments. Each of those references start with a clause to the bill, and then the actual change in the act that's been changed. Just for your reference. And again, the explanatory memorandum is there, and that has a table of contents that links directly into this. And now I will turn it over to Franz.
Thank you, Keith. Thank you, Chair. Right. Now on to some of the administrative points. A number of these would assist in SARS's modernization agenda, and we'll work through how they work. Some of them clarify issues. And let's start off with interest. I mean, we all know that if you have money that is in fact somebody else's money, you get to either pay interest or receive interest, depending on which way the funds are flowed. Now, in terms of the Income Tax Act and the Value Added Tax Act, you can end up in a situation where you're in a dispute with SARS. And you may lodge an objection because you're disagreeing with what SARS has to say about a particular aspect. And in fact, SARS may attempt to enforce payment of the funds even though you have that objection or that appeal if the objection is ultimately disallowed. Now, there's been a great deal of debate in the past about this, and that finally went up to the Constitutional Court as to whether what is known as the pay now, argue later principle would apply, and the Constitutional Court affirmed that it would. But one of the aspects of pay now, argue later, is that if SARS has got your money, we need to pay you interest. And as it stands at the moment, the Income Tax Act and the VAT Act don't require SARS to pay you interest if you have paid us before the objection is settled in your favour. So two things could happen. You could object, you disagree with how we've assessed you, you pay the money in, and then one of SARS allows the objection. We say, on further reconsideration, you're correct. In fact, shouldn't have gotten that money, you need to get it back. We don't pay you interest. And that's what we're correcting here. We're saying, right, we will pay you interest on that. Now, that's where we've enforced payment. And the question is, when should we be enforcing payment? Now, after the Metcash decision by the Constitutional Court, SARS put out a media statement that said, these are the kinds of circumstances where we would generally not insist on payment. And that's all well and good, but that was just a media release. What we're doing here is we're formalising the circumstances and we're making it absolutely clear when we would insist on payments, and then if we do insist on payment, we're making it equally clear that if we allow the objection, we will be paying you interest. On to the next slide. And that's more interest. At the moment, and this is really a historical thing, we charge simple interest. In other words, we do not charge interest on interest. And that's historical because back in the day when you had large index cards in which you kept records of your tax, it was a bit difficult for people who didn't have electronic calculators to in fact work out all this interest and stuff. The world has moved on. We have much more impressive record-keeping systems, and in fact, the kind of record-keeping systems that you get in the market today find the whole concept of simple interest very puzzling, because it's quite out of the ordinary if you look at normal commercial practice. So that's one leg of it. The other leg of it is that because we run on a simple interest system, we have some pretty interesting rules about how you allocate the payments you receive. So if someone owes us a penalty, some interest, and some capital, the rules that we put in, and interestingly enough, at the insistence of the Auditor General, mean that first we have to apply it to the penalty, then we apply it to the interest, and then we apply it to the capital. And because of that kind of ordering rule problem, one of our initiatives, which is to have a single consolidated account for taxpayers, becomes very, very difficult. And so, to cut a long story short, what we're proposing here is that over a period of time we will move to compound interest for our taxes so that we can start moving to this consolidated account. Now, I do take some comfort because someone sent me an article last week, or else earlier this week, that tells me that in fact the UK hasn't even gotten this consolidated account thing right yet. So at least there's another advanced economy out there that is facing the same kind of challenge as we are. Next slide is the allocation of payments to debt. This is a relatively simple one. Someone makes us a payment and doesn't tell us what that payment is for. What do we do with it? Okay, what we're saying here is we need a rule, and the rule is that it goes to the oldest debt. Seems logical. I don't think we need to say more about that. Settlement procedures. We've spoken a little about dispute resolution. You have an objection. You can have an appeal that follows it. And something that can happen in that process is what's known as alternative dispute resolution or a simple settlement. That's where SARS and the taxpayer get together, you look at the facts and the legal dispute told, and you say, right, we both have risks here, maybe we shouldn't be taking this to court. And so you come to a settlement agreement. And just to reassure the committee on one aspect, those settlement agreements are reported to the Auditor General so that there is a control and review function there. And now, the question was, when do you start the settlement proceedings? When do you actually implement them? Can you do this before the assessment is raised? The answer to that is no, you probably shouldn't, because you need to know what base you're working from, so that's the assessment, and after that you can come to a settlement. And so we're proposing that the legislation be clarified to make that abundantly clear. Right, on to the next slide, employee tax. Now, many of you will have had the advantage of the pre-populated tax returns that SARS started sending out last year. And that is dependent on the information we get from employers. Equally, if you think about it, there's a very large amount of money that goes into the personal income tax system and the employee tax system. And reconciling it once a year, which is what we currently do, doesn't really make sense from a control point of view. So what we're proposing here is instead of doing it once a year, we will move firstly to probably twice a year, and then at some stage perhaps 3-4 times a year on a quarterly basis, and there's a proposal to permit the commissioner to require that. Then last year there was an amendment which requires fairly accurate estimates for provisional tax purposes at the end of the year. Your estimate needed to be within 80% of the final actual outcome. Interestingly enough, that is somewhat more generous than India and Ireland, to pick on two countries beginning with I. We both require 100% accuracy at the end of the year. And there are other countries that have similar rules. But in any event, we have an 80% rule. Now, after an extended discussion with representative bodies about the impact this has on small companies and large, we've come to the conclusion that there is some room to assist smaller companies. And so what we're proposing here is that the commissioner be permitted to prescribe a basis for arriving at an estimate. And if you're a smaller company and you stick to that basis, you are protected from any penalties that may be incurred if you miss the 80%. So that's a mechanism to assist the smaller players in the market who perhaps don't have monthly management accounts and the kind of sophisticated record keeping that larger companies do. Right. On to the next slide, which deals with skills development levy and unemployment insurance fund contributions. As things stand at the moment, SARS collects those two on behalf of the Department of Labour, and we collect it as part of the employee's tax system. But there are some inconsistencies in the rules, and it really doesn't make a lot of sense that you've got one form that the same taxpayer is filling in and submitting to the same revenue administration, but the rules are slightly different. So the proposals here are to align the skills development levy and UIF contribution legislation with the employee's tax, so that they all run on a consistent principle. Next up is our value-added tax. Now, value-added tax is a very efficient tax. It does have one problem, though, is that you can get fairly substantial refunds out of it. And where you can get cash out of the government, there are people who like to get it out without being entitled to it. And we discovered that this got even worse when we introduced some simplified registration procedures at the beginning of last year. So we tried to simplify things, cut down on the red tape, and we promptly discovered people were taking us to the cleaners. So we had to tamp down again. And so we toughened up on the procedures. Now, one of the things we would like to be able to do going into the future is we're required, in fact, to use biometric information. So that's things like fingerprints and so forth to verify identity. And that is the proposal here. Customs modernization. Just as we modernize the income tax, so we modernize the customs. This is something where things move pretty quickly. So, just as a matter of interest, the Income Tax Act lives in here with a little bit. This is the Customs and Excise Act with its rules. Okay, so lots of stuff happens in the Customs and Excise Act by way of rule. I should also say it's not all just the rules. That's the act of the rules. This is a commentary. But those are the rules. And what we're suggesting here is that SARS be permitted to issue rules where there are urgent issues that need to be dealt with for the modernisation agenda. And those rules would have to be consistent with the provisions that they're modifying. So it is just a strategy. That brings me to the end of the slides, but since I have such a nice audience here, I thought I'd just make one little point. As we had at the beginning of the presentation by Momo, I mean, we're in a situation where times are tough, and we're looking at quite a significant revenue shortfall. So I don't think it's going to be a surprise to anybody out there that SARS is going to be looking long and hard at people who are avoiding tax and outright evading it. And that's something we're going to clearly have a fair amount of focus on. Now, it's a long-standing point SARS has made, and that is, please come and see us before we see you. Because that way we're likely to be a lot more generous. If we have to come and find you, we're going to be less generous. I think that's just a useful point to make at this time, so that people are well aware of the fact that they could get themselves into trouble, but there is a way to get out of it. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you. I think that last point requires that you take a break for 10 minutes, and then we'll come back, and then we'll engage questions of clarity and so on and so forth. I thank everybody for having the patience and listening so attentively. Can we have tea outside? 10 minutes.
Chair, if anyone wants to see me during the tea break, I'm available.
Once again, let me thank the staff, people, and treasury for such an elaborate presentation. And I must say, it is not even probably half of what we do in terms of this amendment, but I've tried to level that to summarize so that we can be able to engage and discuss with a specific focus on ensuring that this bill does get the attention of the public at the same time. I would therefore propose that for now we allow members of the committee to ask questions and also comments at the same time. Is that in order? Okay, good. Over to you, Dr. George. And then Peter will follow.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. My first question relates to page number 46, slide number 46, on agricultural trucks. So for clarity's sake, you mentioned that TUCH has and Cultural Trust has performed confirmation services for emerging farmers under the proposal. Are there any agricultural trusts that will perform other services, and if so, would they also receive an exemption? And then as far as slide number 17, that is on the medical aid contributions. Now, to take for the proposed national insurance, health insurance scheme, four funding sources have been proposed as necessary. One is to increase the health budget from the general tax revenue. Two is the NHI payroll levy. Three is public sector payments for public sector workers' private medical schemes to be rerouted through the NHI. And then the fourth one is tax deductions for medical scheme contributions to be removed. Now, see, we have actually tackled here number four. And what is the progress on the others, if any? And then my third is not a question, it's more a statement. And SARS mentions that times are tight, and budgets are tight, and that the taxpayers must pay, or SARS will get after them. That's fine. But I think in return, taxpayers must also receive something, i.e. an efficient service from SARS, which mostly they do receive. And also that SARS, as a government department, should also look at operating itself under an austerity budget together with other government departments. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have two questions which are not technical in nature. My first one, Chairperson, I just want to check from SARS on the issue of delaying the implementation of the Royalty Act. I just want to check what was the rationale for this delay. I might have missed it on the budget review or on the present, on the beginning of the presentation. Please pardon me. My second question, Chairperson, is on learnership program. I just want to check with SARS if we have a monitoring system to check if these companies really transfer the necessary skills to the learners. I'm asking this question because in the previous parliament we have been flooded with questions and complaints from the learners that what they are doing at the workplace is not what they are supposed to be doing. They are made to make tea for board members, they are made to photocopy documents for board members and their managers. They are not necessarily trained on what they learned at school or in tertiary institution.
Thank you.
Honorable Dwaza.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is just a clarity from I can see that the bills do cover most when it comes to the, I think, American stuff. When they speak about the ceiling, it's on page 48, the terms of the ceiling incentive. I can see that it has covered the incentives more on the production issues concerning the producers. Now, my concern will be, what about the rest? I do understand though that there were some omissions, but it has more on the really the vehicle or the infrastructure that goes with that. But what about the actors? What about the photographers? What about the scriptwriters that are in the industry? Can then the bill look at that or add something towards that? And then another one is on page I can't remember where though, but I would like to ask that when they do the collection of the revenue, don't maybe it would be proper if Chair, they also look at the infrastructure that is there and be properly utilized and get more money, because you could see my assumption or my perception, the presentation is more on the conglomerate, what do you call it,
conglomerate
companies. And so if really we do our thorough monitoring day, our thorough, you know, on really could be quarterly, we might collect more revenues than just you know, living for that end financial year. Then we see that at the end of the day, maybe we're supposed to have some penalties from ESCOM, or we're supposed to get some, we're not supposed to give these incentives when it comes to the import and export at the harbor. You know, if such methods or such ways of collecting is reviewed. The last one, Chair, is about the EET, which was presented by... Yes. I'm a bit concerned about, you know, if I'm a widow and I'm expecting some money from my husband to die, and knowing very well that our country has been, you know, engulfed by illiterates, who is going to enlighten, who is going to train me as to how, because I'm talking about the people coming from the rural side or coming from the middle class. What is going to happen there? The bill hasn't really addressed as to how. Are they going to do some training? Are they going to outreach? Are they going to have the outreach program? What is going to happen? Are they going to have the outreach program so as to enlighten the people, the community? Thank you, Chair.
I think we can allow it. Sorry. Maybe I should allow for us and Treasury people to respond. And then we'll take it from here.
Thank you, Chair. I think just to go through perhaps in the order, I think the first question related to agricultural trust, people trust.
Thank you. We don't specifically exempt entities. What we do is we say if you engage in a particular activity and you meet certain criteria as an entity, then you're exempt. So once upon a time, we did try the entity approach. The problem there is, of course, that you never cover all the entities that you should. It becomes a very narrow approach. So what we're suggesting is we add an activity, which is the provision or promotion of education. No, sorry, wrong one. The provision and promotion of educational... Again, the wrong one. The provision of training, support, or assistance to emerging farmers in order to improve capacity to start and manage agricultural operations. Now, that's the one aspect. Some of the other aspects that may well come into play in this area as well are the existing activities of community development for poor and needy persons and anti-poverty initiatives, including the promotion of community-based projects relating to self-help, empowerment, capacity building, skill development, and anti-poverty. So, the approach we're trying to follow here is one where you have some generic activities, and then as long as the entity carrying them out is non-profit, has complies with certain fiduciary rules and so forth, then it becomes exempt.
And just
add
one point.
Because
your original
technology,
I think this one is... I just don't know how to use technology. The point that you were worried about is when certain agricultural trusts fall out. Now, when we dealt with them, most of their activities fall within. They have research activities, other activities. Most of them fell in. The only activity that was falling out was the activity that you see here. So they are fully covered and they've been fully consulted.
Okay, and then I think just with regard to the medical aid schemes, I mean, the amounts are normally adjusted every year, the threshold, and the conversion to credit is, I think, just motivated more by admin reasons. There's no national health insurance issues here that's motivated any of the changes. I think that with regard to the third question, and I should say that only because, you know, we haven't looked at any such detail here for that purpose. With regard to SARS, France can answer that, but I think, Chair, just a point to be made, that as the Standing Committee on Finance, the budget of the Treasury and the transfer to SARS and the set plans, for example, are something that you look at. So it will be up to you to make sure they have the budget as austere as you would want it to be, but bear in mind you don't want to cripple SARS so that they don't collect money.
Mm-hmm.
I think you want them to be very efficient. But you also want the spending departments to be efficient. I think we take that point. But France, I don't know, do you want to say?
I think those are all fair points, but just as an anecdotal point, I have an email on my BlackBerry that I received about an hour before this meeting began dealing with domestic travel from our chief financial officer on precisely this point, so it's well taken.
Treasury too, you know, some of us are certainly on domestic flights, we travel economically. I think that with regard to the Royalty Act, the rationale there was that we did at that point see, you know, we hadn't seen the growth numbers yet. But we did see commodity prices coming down. One could see that profits were going to be down. People were losing their jobs. And the motivation was that this would be a small relief to impose a new tax at the time that you have a decline in the economy. I think we felt we should just delay the impact as our contribution to saving jobs. I think on the learnership, Cecil is our expert on learnership.
I'm not sure I'm an expert, but I can try and answer the question. I think one should draw a distinction between a learnership and internship. You're probably referring to internships where people are basically informally trying to get work experience and they don't get any meaningful experience through that. my understanding with learnership, and especially apprenticeship, this is a formal training program. You have to have a formal agreement, there has to be this formal certification taking place, and you only get the benefit if that certificate is successfully completed. So it's nothing to do with the internship. This is a very formal relationship. We are in the process of trying to gather information to see how effective it is. There's the intent of work through the CETA system, and there's lots of questions around it. But the apprenticeship, which hopefully will be revitalized and get new impetus with an amendment to the various acts that the Department of Labor do, hopefully this will be of help in that respect. But I can assure you this has nothing to do with incentives.
I think before Keith comes in on the phone incentive, can I say yesterday we put 5 principles on dictation at the workshop. And I think the point that we were just trying to make is that once you have any industrial incentive, you do pick industries. And it's nice when you have something like learnership, choosing one type of activity, but it's across industries. Once you start choosing industries, of course, we start getting the question, but you're helping them, what about the other industries? Get into the, you know, are we being equitable or fair between? But now that you've chosen the film incentive, you can go into the detail why the artists and others are not interested.
It was just to protect myself. No, I never chose film industry directly. It's been chosen many years before. You will find globally that there are film incentives around the world, starting with the U.S. and the U.K. But you'll see that there's a huge list of film incentives, and the film incentives in like the United States don't just exist at the federal level, but they exist in all the states. So in the U.S., the states compete against each other for the various film incentives. We like film, we want to see ourselves on TV and motion pictures, so there's a lot to be said for that. But what you're talking about here, and I think you raised 2 points that are very relevant, and that is, how far can tax go? And tax is mostly about finance. It's about people with money and getting them to move the money where you want them to move the money. Now, unfortunately for artists and the people you discuss, they don't have any money. The problem for them isn't the tax. The problem for them is to get a job. They need a job. You can give them a tax incentive, but it doesn't do anything because they need the job. And what the film incentive is, and many of the incentives you'll see, is trying to get the people with money to move their money where we want them to be promoting the jobs. And so around the film incentive, what the goal was trying to promote local production in films. And so the money is moved to the right location. Now, there is some serious issues in there. I think we have actually cracked down quite considerably to make sure that it's South African production. But unfortunately, whether South African people get enough of the money, that is something we'll have to analyze further. And one of the things that is in the incentive, like many of ours now, and you'll see that also in the learnership, is that Treasury is asking for information to see how effective these incentives are. So if you're looking to help artists, it's got to be a different way. That's what I'm saying. The other one you talked about was issues of education around the world and helping people out on their finance, you know, to understand their basically financial education. Now again, the tax system doesn't really work well. It's not an educational system. It's about channeling money. What you do have is other things, though. The Financial Services Board is very concerned about the same issue you're concerned about, and that is financial education. One of the things you'll see in the bill, and that's what Franz mentioned, was that it is now an exempt activity to provide that education. So that is being done by the FSB because they're the ones who have the skills to give people education on what financial education, so to speak. And we'll see how successful that program is.
But I think, if I may just add, I think there is a point that, you know, often when we have incentives, even like we have the urban depreciation zone incentive, it does help that somebody markets it. So that in that instance,
for example, Johannesburg markets it quite aggressively, and I think that they see a very positive response. Otherwise, incentives take a long time to take effect. So if you're going to have all these industrial incentives, presumably it gets to people, because people who want to invest tend to hire audit firms or tax advisors, and I think it's less of a problem getting the information through to them. I think when it comes to the general public, though, in this particular instance, I mean, Keith has referred to the Financial Services Board's consumer education project. But in this specific instance of estate duty, I would guess that most poor people would not have an estate of 3.5 or 7 million. So you're probably looking at middle class and upward, and they would probably have some financial advisors at the time who would advise them. It's not to duck the issue of education, just to say that we need to have a defensive approach for how information gets to people. I think that's important. Thank you, Chair. I think you've answered all. There's one on SARS, but I thought it was... Yes, on the collection. Okay.
Just on the question of monitoring and the collection of revenues, each tax has its own natural cycle. So, for example, income tax, just as you fill in an annual return, so does the company fill in an annual return. That means that the kind of audit that you do, the review you do, would tend to be an annual review. Having said that, when we're talking about the very large corporates, we have customer relationship managers at our large business center that engage quite regularly with the large corporates to keep track of what kind of difficulties are they facing, what kind of revenue flow can we expect, just so that we keep up that relationship and we know what's going on in the marketplace. So that's the one aspect. When you get other taxes, then they have a shorter cycle. So value-added tax, if we're talking about a large company, a large business person, that tends to be a monthly cycle. So again, you'll have a more frequent interaction on that tax. The same with pay as you earn. Customs can have the very shortest interaction of all, because there we're dealing with transactions at the border, and those you would review as and when they happen. Although, again, if you're a pretty large importer, you would tend to be on a monthly basis, and we'd have what we might call post-clearance inspections. And instead of checking everything at the border, we will check things on a risk basis on a more periodic sort of event. So it's not something that happens all the time, it happens on a periodic basis based on how much risk we have determined for that particular trader. So if you're a high-risk trader, we'll be checking you more frequently. If you're a low-risk trader, we'll check you not that often.
Khadere, Honorable Khadere, followed by Bosin.
Thanks, Chair. I just wanted to make follow-up in relation to the issue of Lenashi. We will be highly appreciating to taking notice to say maybe you will be informing us that we should be able to build these trade test centers in all of these provinces, because if we can just try and assess in terms of these trade centers, it's very much expensive to get a trade test at this current juncture, and you are going to be able to assist us in us. Especially, you know, issues of the technical aspects. But the other question that I wanted to take out is one. It is in relation to the your international submarine cable. I wanted to get a clear clarity, because as far as my experience that I know that that underground submarine cable is maintained daily. But here you're saying the cable must, the lifespan must be 20 years. I must get a clarity in terms of the lifespan and the maintenance of it. Because you must be able to you know, identify those kind of characters. The last one, it is in relation to the issue of the government land. We must be able, you know, in terms of the the state of the nation address, the president is very clear to say we must be able to address and the issue of redistribution of land. Must be able in terms of you know, characterize exactly in terms of whether how we're going to be able, because city must fast track the process. As you know that at the current juncture, we need to be able to meet the 30% before the 2040. And at the current moment we haven't made that more mark. And we must be able to fast track this process. We must be able to look and determine whether can we be able to meet the periods given to us.
Thanks. Honorable Mthethwa, Adjunct Ambrosini, you come after that.
Thanks, Chair. I've got just one question, which is a bit of a concern as well, that there are people that find themselves losing jobs, not through their own making, but because of a certain situation. And these people are people, mostly the low earners, who wants to save, who've got no other alternative to make their own saving. But the only saving for them that is there is the Provident Fund, or the, let me put it, is the retirement fund. Once they lose the job again, they find themselves being taxed up to this far. I'm looking at this penalty, at this tax bracket for them. I think it's too much for sometimes to do that. For some of them, they needed this money and their own last money to settle certain debts before they get employment again. I wonder whether these issues can be dealt with case by case, other than just to have a blanket statement to say, if you earn so much, if you take a retirement up to this amount, you need to be taxed so much. I'm not sure whether some can look into that issue quite differently. Because we are promoting the poor to be the poor, if that's the formula that is being tried.
Over to you, Baba. Ambrosi.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are obviously at the beginning of a process where we are all beginning to plow through this complex deal and liaise with interests and institutional civil society to get the feedback. But what emerges is almost a sensation that this deal was drafted in a different economic season, a season of prosperity, a season in which there was a hopeful perception that global depression would not engulf South Africa, which now it has. So in that process of reading the bill and receiving input from civil society, one begins wondering whether this vehicle can receive those actions of economic maneuver which need to be somehow, sooner rather than later, put in place to begin addressing what the economic crisis is doing to the economy and the people in it. And the question is really how much space there is to reconsider aspects which are not in this bill and which are responsive to the economic crisis which are being put to us as representatives, as civil society demands. I mean, there is a situation in which people are seeing their assets depreciating at enormous rate, whether it's real estate assets or inventory, and that cannot be utilized as a tax loss or only limited to a limited extent. There are situations in which the provisional tax payments are creating unbearable cash flow problems because we're pegged on a situation of prosperity. Well, now there is a there is a situation of recession. There are situations of two taxpayers carrying a house where now there is only one breadwinner, and there is the possibility, there is the demand of having a much greater measure of, for instance, deductibility of home loan payments over and above interest payments. There is industries asking for a greater measure of fiscalization of social burdens. Now, all these are some of the responses that one can give to people out there who are struggling and suffering. And irrespective of the merits of these proposals, is there willingness on the side of the National Treasury and the Department to reapply the mind, go into the drawing board, and see how this bill can be adjusted to the new economic environment?
Thank you. Momo?
Let me start with the last one. I think the state has to collect revenue. As I've indicated, we are running a projected at least $8 billion down after 2 months. And if there's no money to the state, there'll be no money to the education, health, etc. Just to make the other obvious point, I know the member of the group can see the way of that. And I think you should also bear in mind that tax is imposed on income that you earn and on profit that you make. So if you lose your job and you've got no income, you're not going to pay any tax. Yes, there is hardship, and how we deal with that, I think, is a separate issue. I don't think that there's no intention to change these tax proposals. Certainly, when they were made in February, there was an early indication, if you just saw what was happening in the world, that there was probably going to be a slowdown. Our projections were significantly lower for growth. And I think that a lot of the proposals that are made, remember, is welcome to suggest these for the 2010 budget. I think it's important to bear in mind that tax policy, it's like interest rate policy. It takes a long time before it actually makes an impact as well. And I think that's an important point to bear in mind, unless you just suddenly lower rates, perhaps. But otherwise, I think it does take long to take impact. Yeah, I think I'll move on from those. I think there were a series of questions on learnership satellites. Sorry. Yes, I think you were just reminding me. I mean, the other side, if you don't want to, I forget the exact percentage, but you'll find over 50% of our expenditure will be on salaries of teachers, nurses, etc. I don't have to tell you there are strikes outside. If there aren't funds available for the state, you don't want to, you've got to pay your salaries. You've got to make sure that the infrastructure projects that we have continue. You don't want to stop those. So I don't want to make a case for why the state needs to raise revenue. I think that perhaps I'm just pointing out the obvious point. And one's got to find the right balance, I think, between the need to tax and ensure growth and preserve jobs and have expenditure programs that's targeted to the poor and where there's hardship. It's a difficult balance. And I guess that's why you have government, because you can't put this on autopilot. It involves political judgment as well, and those were the judgments that have been made. To the extent that we have new information, certainly, I mean, one always wants to look at issues. But perhaps just to move on, I think, just on the learnership satellite.
So, maybe. We from a tech side play a very limited role in the skills development and training side. I mean, SARS collect the skills development levy and basically transmit that back to the CCAS and the department. That's basically what SARS role is. They're very limited, but it's an efficient way of collecting the skills development levy. The tax incentive that we have here is a top-up sort of a wage, mini-wage subsidy that is in place to assist employers to do good. The actual monitoring and the quality of the training is really another line department, the Department of Labor here,
And to some extent, I think there is debate between the Department of Higher Education that wants to play a role there. So I think those two departments are probably in a better position to reply to your question.
Let me deal with the bigger question.
The retirement
withdrawal issue. I think the issue that you're raising on the retirement withdrawal, I think it's the key issue that's sitting there. Now, let me just say from a tax perspective, the tax system can't sit around discriminating about what happened, why it happened, I lost my job. When you're talking about finances, you're talking about reviewing millions of people. Returns, you've got to be fairly straightforward. Let me just say the first answers here. When the person putting money into retirement, they got a deduction. So they got a tax incentive for putting the money in order to preserve for their retirement. When they pull it out, they will be taxed. It reverses that initial incentive. For poor people, however, you'll take a look at the graduated rate scale. And that graduated scale means that those people are going to be pulling out less and their taxes is less. There's an automatic stabilizer in there. But having said that, there is a main issue as to how to deal with withdrawals where people are doing it because they've lost their job, and withdrawals where what you'll find that a lot of people do is they shift jobs. And when they shift jobs, they go, oh, gee, look at that retirement money. Gee, I can get that money out now because I'm allowed to do so, and it's time to go on vacation or fix the house. And you're trying to balance the two. And the difficulty in the tax system is there isn't the resources to have an interview with each taxpayer who comes in and says, oh, this is your reason, oh, here's the job loss. You can't do that in the system. It really is more left to the trustees and other things. And one of the things as we move toward retirement reform is trying to make a better balance between the reasons why people withdraw. And that is an issue that's still on the table. It's a more of a regulatory issue. Right now, the problem is you can pull out for any reason. If you improve the system where there was more limited reasons for withdrawal, then you can probably be more flexible on the tax. But right now, we don't have that in place, and it's a reform that needs to be done. The other issue that was there, I'm not sure, was dealing with the submarine cable. Mm-hmm. And there was some concerns whether you can monitor how long the cable exists. Now, typically, the cable will have an actual life of 20 years or more when we check with the industry. Whether that useful life is something else. But up front, you will know that it's a 20-year lifespan or more. So all the cables that we've dealt with should fall within the incentive, if I understood the question correctly. So I think there is an issue there.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, Chief, I may just add to that one. As I understood the question, there was a distinction between maintenance and the capital cost. Now, they're two quite different things. The maintenance is deductible in terms of the tax system on an annual basis. So as you incur maintenance expenditure, you can deduct it. What we're dealing with here is the initial cost of acquiring and laying the cable. And I've actually seen a picture of the cable that has landed, and I mean, it's small. It's about the size of my thumb when it finally comes out on land. But it's an incredibly powerful cable. It's fiber optic. But at that particular cost of the cable and the ships that laid it and all the effort that went into here, that we're talking about the 5% per annum rental, which is because the cable itself has got an extended life. The maintenance is deductible as it's incurred.
Any more comments? Questions?
Just on the land issue, Mr. Chair, again, here, what we try to do is to actually facilitate development on government land where municipalities have taken the view that they're not going to dispose of the land, they're going to retain it as government land and then develop it. There is some tax barriers there which we are trying to deal with. The tax proposal here doesn't deal with land reform in a broader context. That's really a different issue. So it's a question of government has taken the view, we're not going to dispose of the land, we're going to keep the land as government land, but we want to develop it. But there are certain tax problems that help us to do that or hinder us to do that, and therefore we try to facilitate that.
Okay. Thank you. It would appear there are no further comments or questions of clarification. I just want to indicate that at the beginning I did not acknowledge people on my right here, that most of them are from the public. They were observers in this discussion. And I think it was good that I did not do it, so that you could be as open and transparent as possible to all of us. But more on a serious note, in the opening comments of the DDG from Treasury, Momo, he did indicate that this is basically the first presentation to the committee since the bills were published. I want to say it is a process that we're all looking forward to engage with. Obviously, these are very complex pieces of legislation that we have to deal with. And I also take note of the fact that at the time of publishing these bills, the economic outlook was not what it is today. And I think as we move forward and as we get more participation in terms of our program and the program of Treasury as a whole, these factors will be actually be taken into consideration as we move forward. Indeed, we'll take a note from the committee side that the proposed revenue collection for 2008-2009, 2009-2010 do already indicate that the economy is not doing what we expected and anticipated. Therefore, we need to be a little bit more creative without actually pushing the burden to the poor at the end of the day. It is more in ensuring that at the end of the day we assist those who require assistance from the side of the state. Having said so, I think one of the things that we'll have to look at is the impact of this economic global tender and the relationship between what this revenue modernization or tax modernization that you're talking about will have to the ability and the culture of savings in South Africa. But it is a very important element of building our own economy. But I think for now, what I should indicate is that the committee has got a very tight schedule, but we'll try to do our level best to make sure that by the envisaged time period, particularly somewhere around August, sufficient and significant work will be done or should have been done in relation to this bill. The next interaction is going to be with the public on the 24th of June. I think from here onwards, those of us who are tasked the responsibility of making sure that we make sure that the taxpayer does participate in this process, we're going to ensure that it happens. That is not a slogan or a saying that says no taxation without representation. So it is important that people know and support this initiative that we are making from your side. I think we're budgeted 2 to 5 o'clock. We don't have to be here until 5 o'clock if we've finished our business. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry, I've been not reminded to make this small announcement. A very important announcement.
both make and work. You're looking more to the gentleman for committee members. The Jasper's proposal that Honorable is now the committee with